Hello, welcome back to another episode of Challenger Cities, that podcast where people talk about cities and what can make them better and more interestingly less wrong, more innovative, more confident, more creative, and also like the places that do this stuff really, really well. So today we're going to talk about Cape Town, which is probably one of the most photographed cities in the world because it's got amazing mountains and oceans and vineyards and postcard views all over the place. But there's also a different story there, which is fractured neighbourhoods, long commutes, and a city that has been shaped by the architecture of apartheid, as have many cities across South Africa. But my guest knows a lot more about that and what is being done, and he is Rashik Fattah, and he's the founder of Our Future Cities. And he's someone who didn't follow the classical route of urban planning or architecture to get into this. He actually trains as an actuary, which is great because I'm a failed accountant myself. So we can compare some notes about why we're probably not wanting to do that and wanting to do city things. So we'll talk about his way of working away from a cubicle at an insurance company, getting into starting Future Cape Town, which was a blog that grew into one of the country's most sort of provocative, I guess, urban think tanks. And we're going to talk about what it means to design maybe what we'll call the connective tissue of a divided city. Why South Africa can deliver on world-class stadia for a World Cup, but perhaps struggles a bit with things like safe transport interchanges. And a little bit of a provocation, how one of the greatest luxuries a city can give to its people is simply time. Time back, or just making the quality of that time better. We're going to get into some radical ideas from the likes of using the prospect or the potential of Cape Town hosting a future Olympics as a bit of a housing accelerator. And we'll talk about what cities need to do differently to patch themselves back together and to make them more happy and healthy and prosperous places to live, play and work. We're going to draw on examples from around the world, some of which are kind of obvious, some of which are a little bit lesser known and a bit more surprising. But this is primarily a conversation about Cape Town, a bit about the sort of unfinished project of South Africa, because it is still a nation that's only about 30 odd years old and still learning how to stitch itself together and grow and prosper. Anyway, without further ado, here is a brilliant conversation with the wonderful Rashik Fattah. Rashik, thank you so much for being up for being a guest on this, because I think urbanism in South Africa and Africa in general is an under-discussed topic theme that we need to have more conversations about. And there's a few people in this world who are like South African and really good at futurism, and they often point to living in South Africa as like, this place gives me a different perspective on the world that helps me sort of provoke in different ways. Anyway. So that's why I'm very excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, it's great to be here, and it's been great following what you've been doing for seems like quite a while now, both the newsletter and the podcast itself.
It's going all right. It's not what I thought it was going to be when I started it, but like most good things tend not to be. But this is about you. I want to get into some of the work that you do around like future cities. Give us a little bit of an introduction to you, your background, and how you came to be this sort of great urbanist.
I think we have to put a disclaimer around the great urbanist, but I can give you the long story in a short fashion. I've been fascinated by cities and architecture and planning since I was 7, in a very unhealthy way. I grew up 2 neighborhoods from where my city, Cape Town, had planned the Olympic Games of the Olympic Park. You could say one neighborhood away, and seeing those visuals at a young age for, you know, what would be essentially within 5 minutes of where I lived, I would say captured a young brain. That didn't lead to a studies in urban planning or architecture or urbanism. I happened to be good at mathematics in high school and decided to do actuarial science, which is mathematics. Oof. Statistics. And I think they eventually gave me a degree, and then worked at a big corporate insurance company in a cubicle. And during that time, I started a blog called Future Cape Town, which was really just pictures and the odd quote and article after the FIFA World Cup, which South Africa had successfully hosted, to keep conversation going about development. And it was at the time that X or Twitter was rising, and you know, suddenly 2,000 followers. And that led me to leave my career to, at the time, take Future Cape Town into what we thought would be a website and a non-profit that receives funding. We soon learned that a website doesn't generate revenue, and that you'd have to really focus on issues like sanitation and really basic needs to get funding and be really organized. And, you know, you'd be competing with a lot of other needs and NGOs. And so I left my corporate career with no work, no academic background in the field, and just responded to what I'd say is my calling. And that is to find ways to make the future of cities more accessible to people in discussion and to work on projects that that do that and that essentially improve the quality of life for people in a way that looks ahead 5 or 10 years ahead. And soon we started doing research, stakeholder engagement on various projects in Cape Town primarily at the time, to the point where working in a different city and being called Future Cape Town wasn't so appropriate. And so our Future Cities was our hastily thought out name to re-register as something that could resonate with more people in more places. So I always say to our team that everyone is much more qualified than I am, but I am a self-appointed urbanist and I have been for the last 15 years. And yeah, our business is, I would say, primarily two parts. One is urbanism, where we have really cool, ambitious clients, be it government agencies, developers, cultural institutions who work with us on projects which they think are innovative or ambitious to improve cities and city life. And then we have the think tank part, which is our way of continuing to have fun so we can study the Olympics in Cape Town without permission, sometimes without a funder, or we could deep dive into inclusionary housing with a developer client. So yeah, that's what we do. And I think with the right kinds of projects and the right kinds of people, we've been able to work in different cities and different countries. But yeah, that's pretty much, that's the long story in a long way.
It's quite a distinct story though. The thing I really like about doing this is everyone we speak to comes into urbanism with a slightly different bent or slant or background. And I think a lot of people look at urbanism from the outside and they see this bunch of architects or urban planners, and you kind of have to go through that traditional skill set. And the more I'm sort of having conversations with people making a difference in their bit of the world, a lot of them don't come from that. Although I think you might be the first actuary that I've spoken to.
I would say failed actuary, but
I'm a failed accountant.
Yeah, with a degree and a couple of years in a big company, but yeah, that's the baseline.
So when you came into it, I'm really curious about, you came into it from that insurance company. How did you make a dent in the world beyond just having the, turning it from like being on Twitter, having a bit of a blog? Like, what was the thing that meant you could start to make a difference?
I think during the period of the blog, before I'd left my paying corporate career, I've always been a very curious person. And some of the projects we did, which had no clients or had no funding, we would visit public spaces and take photographs and speak to people about the space. We created a yellow box, which we'd put into different public spaces to ask people about the future of the city, which an exhibition company sponsored. So I think that it was really a sort of a curiosity around cities that didn't require permission or to do that. And I think that's something I like to carry through to today. And at the same time, you know, we had lots of young people writing about topics they're passionate about. So a lot of my peers and colleagues who either work in government or work in consultancies, everyone at some point wrote something at the Future Cape Town blog, which I've archived. I sort of occasionally bring it out and they say, oh gosh, I was so bold back then. So I think it was a space with the arrival of social media and Tumblr and those sorts of things where having an opinion in your 20s, early 20s, was cool. Everything was exciting and still is, I suppose. And we were just deeply curious about what we had seen, I think, happening in our travels elsewhere, you know, going to China or going to Spain or Morocco, and wondering why certain aspects of urbanism had not arrived in South Africa or were not priorities. And so I think, yeah, I think that curiosity and people reading about our thoughts is what the entry into the field was. The first client was someone I'd worked with on these projects to try and apply for projects, and he'd ended up in an organization focusing on a particular area in the city, and he's like, you know, please join us on our public engagement process. And I was like, of course, I would love to. You know, this was I would say sort of 8-9 months into the first year of leaving a job, and yeah. I would say from there, unfortunately, he's passed now. But that was such a great break for us to go from writing and doing free research into helping a public process.
And like, when you look at where you've come from, of like looking at those cities from elsewhere on your travels and then thinking about how you apply that to Cape Town or other South African cities. Where are you today? Like, what does that look like in terms of how are South African cities doing? Are you still looking out to the rest of the world and being like, you know what, there's lots of things that we need to bring here? Or are South African cities at a place where it's, you know what, all you guys should really be paying attention to what we're doing here? Because I think when you go through the, I think the whole Challenger Cities thing, often people jump to the usual suspects. And I'm very keen on pointing out that we need to look beyond those usual suspects. So I guess that's my long-winded way of saying, what's interesting, where are you at, and like, are South African cities Challenger Cities?
I think they could be, in a sense that where there's been real impact in, I would say, South Africa and the Global South is where we've been able to have, with fewer resources, have been more practical and human in our approach to solving urban problems. And that means that what I find, and this is a broad brushstroke in a more global north perspective, is that there's sort of a tension around dealing with socio-spatial aspects, different cultures, new communities, lots of sort of gently treading around. And here we've sort of, I think, realized that the socio-spatial responses have to be together. We can do that with people slowly. I think South African cities have had a very particular context, you know, 300 plus years of top-down planning divided by race, land dispossession, Group Areas Act. And so we have a physical landscape that's fragmented, but we also have what I call the sensory and the intangible soft landscape or soft infrastructure where you can't see people's memory and hurt and psychology around space. And I think that's what we have going for us, is how do you navigate that and break down barriers? We haven't done enough of it at all, or by far. I think that's what we could offer to the rest of the world. But I think most of the lessons are still coming from elsewhere. In the sense that I think we have lots to do in terms of people's understanding of public space and the public realm and appreciating it, creating more of it. And in this sense, I don't just mean squares and plazas and parks. We have incredible natural landscapes, but we need to improve people's access to that. And then on the deeper level is we haven't done enough on people's lived experience. And that means from the moment you leave your front door or from where you live to work and back, and that is transport interchanges, which in many cases, because they serve the lower income communities, are badly maintained, uninviting, dark places. And I think you might have arrived at some of our airports. Our airports are extremely modern, extremely bright, mm-hmm. well managed. So I think we haven't invested in the public realm infrastructure in terms of the spaces people use, the services they access, so that those are quality, welcoming, beautiful spaces. And while we might not be able to address all the housing backlog in one generation and build all the transport needed where people, you know, were pushed to the outskirts of cities immediately, there's a sort of dignity and beauty that can be provided to people's well-being and quality of life. And I think that's when we return to Paris and Rotterdam, or we work in different cities, it seems kind of illogical that we just haven't yet widened the sidewalk or the pavement here at the busiest interchange of transports. I think it's a bit of both. But I think what we're finding in our work and growing, I suppose, our confidence of working outside of South Africa is that we can do more with less, we're a bit tougher, and we're happy to engage with socio-spatial issues, whether it's in like the Middle East and different cultures and religions, or whether it's, you know, in Europe, a smaller country trying to navigate mobility challenges. So, yeah, that's where we're at. And I think, yeah, for now, it's still us learning a lot from elsewhere. To be frank.
Where do you look to, though? Because some of those challenges that you talk about, they're not the challenges that like a Paris or a Rotterdam or a New York necessarily face. So like, where do you draw most of your inspiration from when you look elsewhere? Or are you taking it from those places and be like, well, how could we be more like those places?
I think from many places, from within South Africa and from elsewhere as well. You could say that the way that Australia has looked at placemaking as integral to new developments has been incredible. From the branding to opening up spaces between buildings, they've really sort of, for a mid-sized economy, invested and appreciated urbanism, mm-hmm. and they continue to do so in a very sort of intentional, strategic way. We always point to Colombia, and one of my best friends is from there, and I think many of us know the stories, but of its transformation coming from its difficult history. But Colombia did what South Africa perhaps didn't do in, I suppose, teaching people to embrace public space, tackling difficult areas, embracing spaces under freeways, and in a way building culture and society alongside design and architecture and buildings, and where they needed to reorient the city or, you know, make places welcoming, they would put some of the best libraries in a particular neighborhood. And, you know, suddenly your anchor point is not just the city center or the traditional center. So I think they did a lot of the work South Africa has, I would say, been afraid to do around, you know, spatial justice and making more city in a way by investing in properly and not in light ways in different neighborhoods. And then I think some cities you need a longer period of time to build an appreciation for the change. And in that case, you know, I look to Paris, which I don't think I was in love with 15 years ago, but I am now. And I think when you return to a place, and I wouldn't just say it's sort of the mayor Anne Hidalgo, who's had a massive, you know, I remember going to a conference which she invited us to in 2016, but I think a great mayor is great to have. But I think from those earlier days of visiting Paris and going every, let's say, year or 2 years during the Olympics and after, we really got a sense that it was just a different level of livability, which doesn't keep everyone happy. But it was doing a lot of things right across the city, quietly, strategically, social housing, spaces. And I think the swimming in River Seine has gotten all the media attention, but it's really, you know, it's like the sparkling water in the parks. It's elderly exercising in outdoors, in outdoor gyms. It's lots of safe cycling and safe walking. I remember around the earlier days in Paris, and this is over a decade ago, you know, you really were risking your life getting on a bicycle.
Yeah.
So I think it's the big popular things that are on the blogs and in the New York Times, but I think it's a lot of the small things. And so when you go to different neighborhoods now, it's not just the center of Paris. It's really outside the center. You know, we saw bridges literally being built to connect different parts of the north of Paris, which is considered outside of Paris, in the Seine-Saint-Denis area. And they've been, I would say, quite literally stitching the city together and doing good urbanism. And that's the case where we look to them because you can really make a difference even in a place like Paris in 15 years or less.
You touched on a few things there that I'd almost like call like connecting tissue.
Yeah.
So like you could go back to like 1968 and the student protests in Paris. And one of the big challenges was like the students were being pushed further and further away from where their education was taking place. But like the RER that they've been building in Paris, it's very much about connecting. How do you connect all the suburbs together, not just connect everything into the center? And when you talk about Colombia, it's like not having everything in one specific place in the city and putting destinations in neighborhoods so that you aren't just drawing people from those neighborhoods, you're taking people to those neighborhoods. And then when you talked about things like sidewalks and transport interchanges, and but when people leave their front door and placemaking not just being about parks and plazas and things like that,
yeah.
Again, all that speaks to me is like, the cities that are doing this really well, they're making their connecting tissue work. And it's a long time since I've been to South Africa, but my experience of not so much Cape Town, but more like Durban and Johannesburg was like the connecting tissue of the city wasn't really there. So a lot of the time I'd find myself in a car, other people would find themselves in a minibus, but like they're not, that you would never have really called them like walkable or connected cities in a way. And I think if you work towards that, that's how you make cities that don't necessarily have the most amount of resources, or they have an unequal divide of resources. That's how you make them much more harmonious, connected, prosperous places. So
yeah,
I think there's something really interesting in the analogies in the places you're picking up on that.
Yeah, I recall stealing a line from a friend, Brett Pitzer, who's a mobility specialist in the Netherlands and a former colleague. I gave a talk in New York and he said, why don't you say we're the world's most designed cities? You know, there you are in New York saying, I come from the world's most designed city. And the terrible part of apartheid was, which was, you know, formal oppression based on race and formal segregation in multiple areas of life, was that they were extremely effective in designing cities to keep people apart.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the most designed cities, South Africa, Cape Town, Durban, Johannesburg. So if you look at Cape Town, the best areas near the mountains and the ocean were cleared out, demolished, if you weren't Caucasian. And Durban and this, the patterns remain in place today. So you're right. Connective tissue is what we have to build incrementally and to bring people along to see a different way. And I think we're just not doing nearly enough at any reasonable pace to take the lessons from, I think, the cities we've mentioned.
When you say not doing nearly enough, like, what is being done and how not enough is it?
I think there's some early, I would say, you know, our first election in 1994. I think there's some of the lingering philosophies around city making from then, which wasn't to radically transform the South African city. The earlier decades were about dignity. So if you lived in an informal settlement quite far from the center, government law would say that if a free house or through government's program would be pretty much a matchbox built with bricks equally far away, because that was the land that was free and available. So we essentially had an incredible housing program, the biggest outside of India, but built for primarily the black and what we call colored communities very far away in the same areas that were disconnected from formal transport in poor quality homes and didn't go for medium density near the center. We didn't have the period of radical urbanism, and I don't think we still have it. So what has been done is a significant housing program. We then had a big shift in thinking in the 2015s when there was a recognition that promising free housing wouldn't work. It wasn't possible to deliver free housing at scale, and that people living in informal settlements needed upgraded services. And so that was a big shift to say, oh, well, we will now provide lighting and in places where we might have endlessly promised housing. And I think I would say we then had the FIFA World Cup era with the advent of bus rapid transit to complement rail. And it was only really reasonably successful in Cape Town, who's continued to expand that bus system. So I think there's been, I would say, for any other country, really big moves to get the basics right. You can imagine that with a population that's 85% non-Caucasian or non-white, schooling had to be built,
mm-hmm.
school buildings. So it's hard to, I wouldn't say nothing's been done. I would just say that we didn't embrace the spatial transformation logic and the radical urbanism that might have put the best universities and schools in certain neighborhoods. And in that, we lost the chance to really integrate better. We might still have that, but I think the pressure on Nelson Mandela and those earlier years was really around the basics. And if we look at the positives of that, I would say, you know, in the last 15 years, average life expectancy has gone up for women by 10 years. Average life expectancy for men has gone up by ages. So for a number of reasons, healthcare has significantly improved, especially public healthcare. And I would say in our province, extremely functioning public healthcare system compared to other provinces. So I think, yeah, I if I had to say what it was, I think the you know, the sort of radical creative urbanism that builds that connective tissue and builds medium density housing close to jobs, that wasn't embraced. And I think we will continue to pay the price. There's sort of sustainability costs of having mm-hmm. people travel and live far away from opportunity.
It's sort of interesting. I was having a chat earlier this week with someone who's talking about Montreal and how for 20, 30, 40 years, the investment wasn't there in the infrastructure. And then you hear at the end sort of go, well, hang on a minute, what was happening in other places? And then you go and apply that to South Africa, where, like, well, there was multiple generations of not having homes, not having jobs, not having transportation, and also you're not allowed to go there.
Yeah.
So, like, how you heal from that is phenomenal. Like, I don't think most people can really wrap their head around that happened in the not too distant past, and you're still trying to sort of build back from that. And it's totally different levels of problems faced, albeit there is that sort of gap of we stop doing stuff for a time, or we, like, deliberately stop people from doing something for a time. And I think it's interesting that your response to it can be quite methodical and planned, and like, how do we think about it? Or your response to it can be like, there's actually probably 25 different ways of solving the problem, and how can we try and be resourceful and see what are the more interesting ways that we can start trying to do something that's far less worse than what was happening before. And I think there's, like, I'm sure that happens, but you're probably always looking at it with the sense of, but we need to 10 or 100 exit.
Yeah.
I think that's, like, a thing that's sometimes really hard to get your head around.
Yeah. We also, I mean, for those who are not aware, we also had to build, we had to do country build, nation building.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this sort of physical side, there was the healing, and we had the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where people would come forward and speak of the harms and murder which they had committed in that period under apartheid. But and then we have the nation building, which is, you know, forming a country under a new flag within, you know, we're a 30-year-old country in all senses, and getting everyone to believe in that there's such thing as a nation with different cultures, nine different, you know, different regions, 11 different languages. So the nation building part is also really, really important. which we sometimes underplay, and I would say has been imperfectly achieved within 30 years or less, often related to sport, finding an interesting case of how to make a country despite our extreme challenges around poverty and crime.
I found it really interesting if you do the, as a tourist, you go do the Soweto thing, and they sort of show you around and you kind of get the, here's the really bleak historical side and here's the sort of, here's how the healing is taking place effectively. And you only see this really small snippet on a few hour tour. But like, I think there's something really, I don't know if it's the real story or if it's like a real story or if there's 100 different perspectives of it, but like you see little pockets of the positivity side of it and you're like, it's actually like kind of, you know what, we can learn a lot about like that little sliver of urbanism looks kind of good.
Yeah,
but I don't think you're necessarily seeing the real story. So like, what is it that sort of holds it back from like happening as fast as it needs to happen? And like, what do we not know about that we should know about in terms of like how do you turn that around effectively? Because I just think it's one of those sort of challenges that it's really hard to like wrap your head around, but sometimes you just get sold the don't worry, it's all fine, here's the warm fuzzy feeling. And I want to sort of get both sides of the, or the various sides of the problem there effectively.
I have my ideas about the pace and the scale, and I think when it comes to housing and introducing a range of affordability, there is no lack of publicly owned land, be it the city government, the regional government, the national government. But the vehicle to deliver those mixed income housing projects and the capacity in the world perhaps does not exist within site government. And you might get a building every 5 years or 10 years. I think we've had zero inner city affordable housing products in the last 25 years, with tons of, I would say, in Cape Town, public land, parking lots, harbor controlled areas, provincial government controlled areas. So the block is not a lack of, we've got some of the best architects, some of the best urban designers, some of the best developers. I think it's the vehicle or the institution which you form to deliver that, with a leader whose job is to deliver X number of units and over time. So I think in that way, sometimes I think it's really institutional. We've worked with developers, some of them luxury apartment developers, who with a company of 20 or less people have built or are about to build 20 buildings in the last 10 years. And so that creates a tension in our society because we have a deeply, I think we're the most income unequal alongside Bogota and Johannesburg. And so what enables a developer to be able to move at such pace, acquiring the land, financing the land, and when the public land is already available at no cost? So what is and why are we making the viabilities coming from finance so complex? I think most projects' viabilities can be done on one spreadsheet, really. So I think it's institutional. And another area might be the mandate that our different governments have. Does any tier of government have a requirement to deliver this kind of housing? Or is its job to do, you know, maintain water infrastructure, fix public transport? Because we have different competencies in different spheres of government, is its job to maintain the status quo and to do that? And sometimes we find that that local government definition, which is a very South African one, is different to the regional government, which looks at education and police and health. And we have, I would say, quite a centralized approach to everything, where our national government controls most, if not all, of the tax revenues and deploys it to regional governments and so forth. And so you have cities as economic powers, but not with the mandate or the ability to raise taxes or like other parts of the world. And that means that maybe under certain definitions, certain spheres of government don't see themselves as investing in public good, but simply maintaining and operating. So I think that is some of it. I would say, secondly, South Africans are really good at deadlines. And the great benefit of the FIFA World Cup in 2010 was we hate nothing more than a global embarrassment. And we were able to renovate and build 3 new airports, upgrade 5 stadia, build 5 new, introduce new bus systems within 4 to 5 years. And I would say deadlines are really, really good for us. And we're big advocates of the Olympic Games to do that acceleration, to create the deadline in which really the public benefits in the long run.
I think this is the interesting thing around the Olympics, which is housing. So like, yep, when you host a World Cup, you get stadia, you get some sort of international transport infrastructure. And normally the bits to get you to and from things can be a bit sort of band-aided. Like, we'll get it good enough because we only have to get you to so many games. there's something interesting about the Olympics, which is because you've got to actually house athletes, like tens of thousands of athletes for a month, then you have a bit more of a legacy when it comes to housing. And it builds you some institutional capability, not around just building the stadium, the venues, but about around building things that if you build 20,000 or 30,000 units for an Olympic Games, you then end up going, well, we could probably build some more of these things now. So I'm interested in your take around like on the Olympics. Cape Town tried to host the Olympics in 2004, was it?
Yeah, 2004, which we narrowly lost to Athens. I would say that was the sort of romantic South African days, just, you know, a newly born democracy and bidding for everything and telling a good story. Yeah, we formed a think tank called Cape Town 2040, and we've actually looked into the quantum of housing that could be delivered through Olympic Games. And, you know, you're looking at a case where you probably need 20 Olympic Games to start to address the housing backlog. And that said, if we had the Olympics, it would still be the largest sort of single decade of housing delivery in a particular medium density type. So yeah, we've got a huge student housing backlog, and we've got a huge affordability backlog in terms of various products of affordable housing. And so the two would fit together, the need to house athletes and to deliver housing. But we would need really 20 or 25 Olympic Games to start to do that. Yeah. So that's an example where you say, okay, there's a very direct legacy to hosting that, but it's just the start of delivering at that sort of scale. And yeah, that could be student housing, social housing. And you could even say, let's rely less on hotels, which the IOC does require, but let's actually build more housing than, you know, even Paris would. Let's house all the media in new housing. Let's house all the athletes. And those that really need to stay in hotels and Airbnbs can do that. So yeah, we've really looked at the numbers, and I would say you'd really want to maximize the housing legacy, yeah, because that deadline would be so important to get a lot of it done.
I think it's the interesting thing of, you talk about the deadline thing and then you talk about sort of major events. It's clear that some of the skill sets exist, but it's then it's sometimes the urgency in the organization around it. And I think like that's you need a catalyst effectively to take some, to drive a moment of change effectively. And I think like that's like nobody really wants to bid on Olympics anymore because they're really expensive. So I think the IOC are probably quite happy if someone's like, oh good, you want to host the games, fantastic.
It's very interesting. It's suddenly changed again. And in the last, I think outside of the pandemic, in the last 2 years, because Paris and LA and Brisbane have been secured, the interest is now just back to where it was before, because they've had such a long runway of host cities confirmed that everyone is back. And I think the Paris model was so successful. It's one thing to talk about sustainability and, you know, measure it and report on it. It's another thing for one of the world's most famous cities to take on an Olympics and show in every stream how you could make it more sustainable. And I think that was a great success of Paris. Mm-hmm. Apart from being Paris, was we will show you what we can do with what we have, using iconic sites, using, you know, Place de la Concorde is really just a parking, but you know, just an open space, and they put seven sports in the center of Paris and cleaned up the center to a reasonable degree. I would argue not. And so the best advertorial as post-Tokyo, which is during the pandemic, was to say, here's a live city. Bring your city and your project and let's see what we can do with that. And now there are so many cities back in the ring, yeah. I'd say up to 14, because the new model has been demonstrated. I think that's really important, to demonstrate what is possible.
It's not very fashionable anymore, but nobody wants to host the Commonwealth Games. So maybe that's an easier one to aim for.
I think that's a different. I think that's a different issue on purpose
I think that the connecting points that you make there around like Paris, and like you can bring this and apply it in Paris. So therefore, like, what would the different context look like to go and bring something like that to Cape Town? How do you then take the strengths of what South Africa does really well, and as that the catalyst to the things that it's been struggling with over the past couple of decades? I think that's like, there's a really interesting provocation in that.
It really is, because it asks questions around, you know, Paris used different parts of France and different regions of mm-hmm. France, so suddenly it becomes a South African question, and using the best surfing location, using the best natural settings. We don't have an Eiffel Tower, we don't have maybe, you know, the Grand Palais, but I think the best, you know, we probably have 40 options for mountain biking and, you know, 65 options just for ocean swimming. I think that's what we've been looking at through our work in Think Tank, is what is the best that could be put forward that is both regenerative and sustainable. And that becomes a really interesting proposition for, I think, for any place, and not just for South Africa, but I think, you know, whether it's Nairobi or Cairo, how do you bring the best of your region and host something like that and leave a great legacy behind?
Yeah. I was going to say, how much do you look to other African cities? Because the challenges aren't the same, but some of the constraints have some commonality. And I think, like, I think there's bits of Cairo to me that are like incredibly resourceful. There's bits of, like, went to Dakar earlier this year, and there's bits there, and you're like, okay, you're making some really big statements, and you can see how, like, these bits of infrastructure are transforming how the city grows. All these cities have the, I think, the mentality of they're doing things in a more interestingly less wrong way. By no means perfect, but, like, how much do you look to other African cities, or how much do other African cities look to South African cities when it comes to the futures that we want to create?
Yeah, I think most of the last 15 years has been looking to and engaging with different African cities. One of our colleagues was moved to Cape Town from Lagos and has started her own initiative called the Lagos Urban Mobility and Development Initiative, and looking at non-motorized transport and how women move through Lagos, despite the, you know, depictions of Lagos as being purely chaotic and dangerous. I think I'm also surprised. My first time in Morocco, in Casablanca for a conference, and South Africans do have a bit of a chip on the shoulder, but, you know, through the center of the city, here comes the tram through the public spaces, and you're like, wow, okay, well, we've got a bit to learn about that. I think that the financing models for transport and across Africa has been much more progressive than South Africa in terms of, in some cases, funding from China for train systems, and in some cases, co-funding with parts of Europe for new train systems, you know, the first generation. So I think we've seen a lot of different models. I think South Africa is still stuck on the central government funding approach to all transport, and rather than letting companies get involved and deliver mobility services, they're still holding very tightly. And that affects the pace, I think, which means you can only deliver based on who's in office, if they believe in the system, and whether they're willing to release the funding. And then I think I'd really love to go to the Dakar. I haven't been to Dakar, but the Youth Olympics next year, which will be the first Olympics in an African city, and just seeing what they bring to in terms of hosting, in terms of, you know, focusing on young people and how to bring young people into sport. And then we've also seen in some cases where a mayor, in the case of Freetown, has purposely been bold in their decisions in terms of how to finance different parts of the city, how to generate revenue, implementing new planning systems, all within, you know, one or two terms. So I think, yeah, I think that there's always been a conversation around what's happening elsewhere across the continent, but I think that can be enriched further. We were part of an event run by ICLEI Africa for a few years, especially in the days of online conferences, which really brought, called Rise Africa, which brought together different African cities and continents, different African cities and institutions and companies to connect and to have discussions around urban development, but just, you know, from completely different lenses and different contexts. And that was really interesting.
It's quite cool how you talk about the transport things and then the funding thing. So I think like that's like a, like Casablanca is not a brilliant city. Yes, offense to people who might listen to this from Casablanca, but it's not like, maybe it's because it's not like it's not what you have in your head as a Moroccan city. Maybe that's unfair, but it's not one of the cities that I sort of like yearn for. But like the way they've gone about how do we elevate this has been anchored around like the transportation.
It's not the movie I thought it would be.
There is a fake Rix bar in Casablanca though, so there is that.
They've just got like this, you know, I think it's the Grand Mosque, and like from the Grand Mosque all the way along the promenade. I mean, that's just a public infrastructure gold mine about how you could really enhance that stretch. And it's all really there. You just have to continue to invest in that full experience. Because I recall walking that most of that as well. I think in places like Nairobi, there's a lot of concern around some of the new freeways, the elevated freeways, and whether that's the right solution for that city. But I think what people are realizing is, and this may sound obvious, but it that it's a massive continent and there might not even be that many commonalities between countries and cities. And the characters and the languages and French, Francophone Africa and Southern Africa. And this also relates back to Cape Town in South Africa, where because we've had such divided cities, I would say that most people don't know 80 to 90% of the city. So I often bring up presentations, pictures of Cape Town in different neighborhoods, and I don't think people know those institutions, buildings, or have been there or ever needed to go there. So our lived experiences were so divided and still are in many ways that you're not required to go into different areas and neighborhoods, and even really good things you wouldn't know about in other places. So I think there's a long learning process about what's in our own cities and our own continent.
It's what makes the Dakar one interesting, because like the train from the airport to the city, I think they've only just started fully running it on the full distance, and the airport's a long way away from the city, and they kind of have a sporting capital that has a university, I think, halfway along it. But it's changed the dynamic of how the city grows out. So a lot of the formal development happens along the train line, and a lot of the informal development happens elsewhere. Mm. And it just shows like the nature of centrally funded big transportation infrastructure projects completely transforms how a city grows and develops, for better and worse. So when you don't necessarily have the funding in the city and the funding's coming from the federal government, it does. I think that's a big conversation that people are sort of trying to figure out, how, what are the other creative ways that we can finance this, and what are the ways that we tell a story to national government that gives more confidence that local government can go and spend and invest money and build something that's going to transform the city, that then leads to tax revenue going back the other way. Something, there's lots of interesting connecting threads here that I think we have them in lots of places, but you see the difference for how they impact a place based upon what's been delivered or not been delivered.
Yeah, finance is a big question for, I would say, the Global South. And I think we haven't quite gotten to grips with measuring the quality of life benefits and the well-being benefits of some of the infrastructure. We still seem to be guessing around whether in 10 or 15 or 20 years' time, let's say, young women are safer in public transport interchanges than 20 years ago. We don't know how new playgrounds and sports parks have affected young people as an investment. And so I think I really love the quality of living and the livability rankings, and they often don't include us. But I think we need to get better at tailoring our infrastructure and what we invest in to directly benefit large groups of people in terms of travel time to work, travel time to jobs. And we seem to be really good at reporting on spend expenditure and building infrastructure and not being able to quantify the benefit to people in ways that you could track over time. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like an airport where you know that where the planes arrive on time, what percentage left late, you know, the passengers, you know. But when it comes to, I would say, the majority that are often not given a sufficient voice, we're not good enough at tracking that benefit and tracking the overall quality of life that people have.
Or even just getting the early signal. If you can often point to an infrastructure project 10, 15 years after it was delivered, and you look at it and go, that was so obvious. Why were we having such an argument about building it? But what you actually need is the obviousness to build it in the first place, but then the early signals of this is working. So you build the next one almost immediately, rather than it often being like they skip generations between these things getting built. I think like that's that's a really big important piece.
I would say the difference in a city like Cape Town is that it really can be great for everyone. And I think you might, if we can address certain aspects of people's lives, it really can be great and not mediocre or slightly good. But it's a city in which when people can access opportunity and they can be significantly safer, it becomes a really great quality of life for almost everyone. When you're wrapped with oceans on both sides and natural wetlands and mountains on the other sides. And so you're not talking about living in a city that people are too far away from or can't access, but people really are wrapped in what Cape Town has to offer. And in terms of quality of life, I think we don't focus enough on time and giving everyone more time to be able to embrace the city more. We know that even in places like Paris, moving 5 kilometers by a really good public transport can take you 45 minutes. Mm. And so in a South African context, if people are traveling 2 hours plus to and from places of employment, accessing that national park in the evening or truly benefiting from proximity to the best the city has to offer is not possible. So I'm really a big advocate of saying, well, how do we reduce travel times and really give priority to people in buses and on trains whatever we have to do in those peak hour periods to give them the priority. And I think not enough is spoken about that. We've seen a bit of the thinking change, especially in the pandemic, where let's say you worked in a call center, or employers were able to provide Wi-Fi where people lived, and so they could do their job from where they were and travel in later. But I think time is really, really big luxury that you can start to give people, and I think that's why we've seen shifts around the world around where people want to live.
Yeah,
because the commutes and the what they want to do in one day, it's not possible to do in some cities.
I think if you took a city that has the geographic location that people look at and go, oh my God, I'd love to live there, Cape Town's definitely up there in terms of like climate, geography, scenery, the activities around it, like all of that is like, it's such a desirable piece. But then it's when you're on the ground, how do you actually make it so that you can live there, you can get to a job there, you can go to the beach there, you can see friends there. And I think like that's the, I get people tease me for talking about transport too often. That stuff genuinely changes how you live, play and work.
Yeah, I think some of the best leaders are purposely organizing their cities. And that means making really tough decisions about who gets priority in certain areas, whether it's walkers, cyclists. And I think it's you often spoke about in terms of, car-free cities or moving cars out. But I think it's about how do you organize your society so that the most amount of people can move through a space comfortably and safely. And that's in car-centric places, Africa is one of them. That's a lot of politicians have been really afraid of upsetting car drivers. And so, yeah, we've got to cross that hurdle as well.
It's not unique to Toronto. So I like to end these with a little bit of a magic wand. So if you could extract yourself from some of the day-to-day realities or constraints for making Cape Town or South African cities, Challenger cities, what would you do with a magic wand?
I think for people, the magic wand would need to lift those that are in, I suppose, their economic circumstances and really struggling to survive on, I would say, lower income groups or people that are essentially living in poverty out of that into middle income. And I often refer to Brazil, which had a huge economic shift in the last three decades where they built a big middle income. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing for people would be to lift people out of that and to significantly increase safety and reduce the levels of violent crime, which is in certain neighborhoods, some of the worst in the world. I think in the sort of built fabric side, it's really going to be a series of high quality, high speed trains to connect the city and the region. I would do sort of crazy things like, in peak periods on the roads and freeways, you can't be a single occupant driver. You've got to be a school bus, a minibus taxi, a bus, just for 2 hours. It's mass transit priority on all freeways to get people to where they need to be. Just because, you can leave the city at a certain time, the city center, and there'll be a single occupant driver for various reasons. Maybe their neighbor doesn't have a public transport link or rail link, but they'll be in a lane next to a bus filled with 80 people. And there must be a better way of doing that where the buses of 80 people get home in a reasonable time. So I think that would be really important. A second magic wand swoosh would really just be around large scale housing delivery that you've just never seen before in good locations near jobs, real medium to high density, 50 years of big supply side theory, big supply and if you can lift people out of extreme poverty and house them in job nodes, I think the rest becomes a bit easier.
Yeah. There's something like really, I just kind of look at places like South Africa and I sort of see when I went there, there was a little bit where I was thinking, is this a bit like parts of California where there's the version of how this city is developed is kind of like the land use isn't hugely different, but you end up with this like big sprawling sort of metropolitan area, obviously with all the context of the politics of South Africa. And you look at that and go, well, if I had a magic wand to apply to it, I'd almost like look at it and go, what's the huge, big innovation around sort of like modular housing that you could deploy that would give people a far more safe, prosperous, healthy, dignified place to live and that you could produce at massive scale? And how do you connect that through transportation, whether that's sort of like the Cape Town S-Bahn or whether it's autonomous vehicles or BRTs or things like that? I think there's a fascinating social experiment there with technology that isn't fantasy, but we haven't managed to deploy it at scale anywhere. Like, that would be mine, because I think you end up making quite an impressive place to live at that point.
Yeah, and I think it goes back to that understanding the city and understanding Cape Town. The postcard images of Cape Town and Table Mountain and the center and the waterfront, that's 70,000 people out of 3.5 million. You know, that's not where everyone lives, but that's where a lot of the jobs are. And that's the biggest jobs node, I would say. We really are a suburban city. We're a big sprawling suburban city with formal suburban houses, including what we call townships, which are now also mostly formal dwellings, despite having large informal areas. And that goes back to making a city. Where do you put institutions and what do you connect and where? And that points back to our missing radical urbanism, which wasn't ushered in from the early 90s.
Maybe it'll come in from the mid-2020s. So
hold tight for my run for mayor. Hold tight. The era of tyranny is coming.
I'll come back and interview you when you're on the campaign trail.
Yeah. You just give me 35 years.
I could chat to you all day because it's a topic I'm fascinated by, and you keep pulling on like interesting things. I'm like, oh, I want to ask about that. And I basically ran out of time. But like, I hope people go and check out some of the thought pieces you've got on Our Future Cities, and there's loads of amazing case studies that come out of this. And then you should probably think about hosting a big urbanism conference in South Africa and getting lots of people to come visit. Just saying.
We in the early days of our business, we did events, and we got busier and did less events, and we really need to do that again. And whether it's a placemaking week or whether it's in different places in which we work, but we really need to think about bringing people here. That said, Cape Town is an extremely popular conference destination. I think there's, you know, 17 conferences here a week on every conceivable topic. So I'm sure you'll find a reason to return.
I'll find an excuse. I can always find an excuse to go places.
live coverage from Cape Town, yeah.
Thank you, mate. That was a good chat.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, as always, listening all the way to the end of one of these Challenger Cities podcast episodes. I do need a favour, though. This thing's growing, it's getting traction, it's amazing hearing feedback of people listening to it, but I always need a little bit of a stroke to the ego, and this thing can go bigger and further and wider with your help. So please do give it a like, give it a share, leave us a comment, suggest it to a friend. Thank you so much, and as always, get in touch if there's people you think we should talk to. So, see you soon for another episode in what is now series 4 of the Challenger Cities podcast.